friends of ours run not exactly an orphanage, but an enrichment program for underprivileged children in Rishikesh, India. Their hope was to have an orphanage, but so far the complexities of bureaucracy, which are 100 million times worse in that country than anywhere else, have prevented them from formally doing an orphanage. So what they did, not to be deterred from their desire to help children, they simply started art classes and music classes and things like that, really mostly out of the home that they live in, and they just started helping the children in the area. The woman, Shala, is an extremely gifted artist, just extraordinarily gifted artistically, and she's focused a lot of what she's been able to do with these little children on art. And among the things that they do is she's had them in a way for them to earn money, and not really to earn money for the project, but for the children themselves to earn money. And the money that they earn, she's putting away for the children's dowries, not really giving it to them. But they make cards, and they cut out little things and paste them on, and glitter and glue, the kind of thing. Most of the children are, you know, 10, under 10, so they do that kind of art. Now, Shala was speaking. Somebody brought over a pair of Teva sandals. She was so thrilled because Tevas are so sturdy. She says some of these children just have half a pair of shoes virtually that's worn out. She says it costs 40 rupees for a pair of rubber thongs, or maybe less than that, which is less than a dollar. But many of the families can't afford that. Seems like nothing to us, but they can't afford it. And they live in, one of the little children took Durgan Vidura over to see where he lived. And he just lived in a, you know, just a lean-to made out of plastic. And it gets fairly cold in Rishikesh in the winter. He was very proud of it. It was his home. Now, the reason I'm saying all this is that one would have an inclination to think, to take care of these children and coddle them. The interesting thing about Shala is she's very strict with them. And they demand cleanliness, they demand proper comportment, they demand proper manners, and when they're doing their art, if they cut the picture sloppy or paste it on crooked, she makes them pull it right off and start over again. She doesn't say, oh darling, everything you do is wonderful, you're a great artist. You know, she tells them all they have the potential, but she holds them to a very high standard, and they meet that standard for her because she demands it of them with so much obvious commitment to their well-being. She's not afraid to risk challenging them. She just asks them to rise to it. And others, people are sometimes a little shocked almost by how strict she is with them. You know, you're sort of inclined to cut them a little slack. Aren't they cute? And after all, they're so poor. Now, it's not that Shala has this attitude that, oh, it's a tough world out there and we've got to prepare them for this tough world or anything like that. It's just simply that if they're going to ever pull themselves out of the situation that they're in, they have to learn to discipline themselves to meet a real standard. You don't help anyone by lowering the standard. Now, I've been contemplating that ever since I became aware of her, of the way she works with these children. And I was thinking of it tonight because we have all these songs. We didn't happen to sing Door of My Heart. Door of my heart, open wide, I keep for thee. Wilt thou come, just for once come to me. Will my days fly away without seeing thee, my Lord? Night and day, I look for thee night and day. Some people, when they first come and hear that chant, especially the part that says, just for once, won't you come to me? People think, well, why should I have to ask with so much intensity? We sort of hear, God is my own already. God is within me. I am one with the Spirit. Earlier in the meditation, Robert was singing a chant that Jyotish wrote, Lord, thou art me. I am thee, Lord, thou art me. Beautiful words. Air, wind and air, wave and sea. It's such a beautiful way of sort of talking about the separateness but the sameness. Wind and air, wave and sea, I am thee, thou art me. You can see that you can perceive a difference, but in fact, where is the difference? But we do experience, all of us, this enormous difference. That's where all this longing comes from. All the stories about Swamiji that are in the book that we've just put out that I worked on for such a long time and have lived for far longer than it took me to write them up. This experience of being in the company, I mean often in the company, of an individual who appears to be similar to every other individual I know and yet looks out at the world and simply sees it differently. Just the simple reality of the world that he lives in is a very different world than the one I live in. And I comment in many of those stories that sometimes I think that Swamiji's behavior is because he's so disciplined. You know, see, that's how I would think of it, which is that I would have an impulse to be impatient or I would have an impulse to be judgmental or fearful, but I would discipline myself and then come across with the right attitude. You know, behave properly, that I may have learned to behave. And time after time with Swamiji, I've discovered, for example, when I thanked him, he's 21 years older than I, and I began to work closely with him when I was still in my early 20s, and I was not nearly as smart as I thought I was. But that didn't deter me from being absolutely fixed in my opinions and just holding on to my point of view, even when it was opposite to his. And really, in retrospect, I must have tried his patience. I just don't know how he put up with it. In fact, a certain number of things he writes that he wanted to do, he simply wasn't able to do because I opposed him so strongly. Like 15 years later, he would say, he said again very patiently, "Yes, you often thwarted me." And I just, you know, how do you do such a dumb thing? But anyway, I did. But nonetheless, I realized that in all those years, he never once made any reference to my age. I mean, even by rolling his eyes. I mean, he never said the most obvious thing in the world, which is, "You inexperienced twit, what are you doing? You know, I've been doing this for decades and you're just starting. How could you possibly?" Never. I mean, nothing, not a breath of it. When I thanked him, because it seemed to me that thanks was long overdue, for being so patient and respectful to give me an opportunity to grow into at least a little more merit of what he was offering me, his answer was, "I never noticed." He said, "Age is just a superficial characteristic of the body. The soul has no age." And in the same way, he commented that he doesn't notice what color people's eyes are, because to him, the eyes are the window of the soul. So what difference does it make what color the eyes are? What matters is the consciousness that comes through it. But what I realized in that is that there's no discipline involved, because there's been a shift in consciousness. You know, looking at a person where my mind might think man, woman, you know, of a particular race or characteristics or physical condition or things like that, his doesn't. His thinks, as he put it once, it's all just egos in various stages of delusion, you know, or putting the other way, it's all just egos on their way to self-realization. And whatever particular quality of delusion you're carrying, it's really entirely irrelevant. The only thing that matters is, how can we help free this soul from what binds it? You know, if you're all just chained up, it's really not very interesting to examine the chains and see where they were made and what country and, you know, what the brand is, and this is an antique one and this is a new one. You know, what you really want to do is you just want to break the chains, because when you break them, they become entirely irrelevant. And after many incarnations of training himself step by step to perceive the world, well, as a saint, as a master, to as the Bhagavad Gita tells us to see it, to the man of wisdom, a lump of gold, a clod of clay, it's all the same. It's not that he can't tell which is which, but each of it is just a vibration of energy to be related to in an appropriate manner, but not fundamentally different in itself. Now, we tend to want God to come to us on our own terms. It's a very simple desire. It's like, it's so much work, it feels like sometimes, or we try so hard. And it's impossible to perceive infinity when we cling to finitude. You know, it's just impossible to see God as long as we're holding on to the thought of ourselves in all these limited ways. Swamiji described once, he said, people are just a bundle of self-definitions, was something he came up recently. You're just a bundle of self-definitions, that's all you are. Meaning, change those self-definitions and you become something else. That's what we're all walking around doing. We're defining ourselves in these certain ways. And as long as our sense of self is intimately connected to something finite, we can't merge with anything bigger than that, do you see? And it's not a question of whether God loves us or not, because he would give us everything if we weren't blocking it with our own vibrations. And the power of longing, the power of love, the power of the songs that we've been singing, the chants that we constantly sing, is in, on many levels, the affirmation. We're saying it as an affirmation. This is all I desire. We sing that chant, door of my heart, open wide, I keep for thee. Wilt thou come, just for once come to me. And part of what we're doing is what, by singing that song, we're trying to build up within ourselves that kind of one-pointed longing. And these very poignant songs of divine longing are meant to awaken within us a hint of the realization, what else could I desire? You know, to put ourselves, because when we have that single-minded desire, that in itself, you see, it opens the door to infinity. Wherever, whatever we treasure, that's where our heart is, that's where our mind is. Swamiji was speaking once about the heart being the key to everything on the spiritual path. Even Sri Yukteswar, in his very in his book, The Holy Science, which I have not read, but I've just except read pieces of it. But it's a very difficult book to read. It's not like it flows in a devotional way. But in a very gyanic way, at the end of it, what Sri Yukteswar says is, the only essential on the path is love. And it seems like such an opposite conclusion from something that demands so much of the mind to understand, because we tend to think of love as a kind of cutting out the pictures badly and then pasting them on crooked, which is, every so often when we feel kind of miserable, we suddenly have this great determination that we're only going to live for God. But that's not enough, because it has to be that we have really separated ourselves from any other self-definition except as a devotee wanting to be one with God. And Divine Mother disciplines us, just like Shala disciplines her little kids up there in India. She disciplines us. It's not enough just every once in a while to half-heartedly sing a chant or do a little meditation or come to the Sangha when it's convenient, but not when it doesn't suit us. In the festival of light, which we do every week, and almost all of you are familiar faces, and you're accustomed to it. Here is the fourth and last stage of the soul's long journey through time and space, the redemption. Now, just before that, we've talked about the great masters, how they give up everything for the sake of others, And then right after that, and you kind of try to think that it's not really referring to such a level of absolute sacrifice, but it does. The fourth and last stage on the soul's long journey, which is to give everything we have in service to God and in service to others. May thy love shine forever on the sanctuary of my devotion, and may I be able to awaken that love in all. I've been aware of the fact that person in my position, I walk a fine line, and I'm never really quite sure which side of the line to come down on. On one hand, one of the most difficult realities I see that devotees face is a lack of self-worth. I heard some television or radio advice giver asked once, why is it that people are so insecure? She gave a very good answer. She said, because there's so much advertising. She said, because everywhere you turn, you're told that unless you have something you don't already have, you're inadequate. But whether or not that's actually the reason, the fact of the matter is, especially in the society in which we live, you are constantly bombarded with the thought that you don't have something that you really need to have. And all images of, even you just start with feminine models and movie stars and all these ideals, they're all presented like they're unattainable. They're just unattainable. I was looking at women's fashions recently, and Tushti and I were talking about this because she shops for East West. I said, who can wear those clothes? You can't be an actual woman and get into those things, because women are lumpy. You know, and these clothes are made for people who just have shoulders and then nothing after it, you know? And that's really sort of how those, you know, surgically corrected women are. That's just, they're just not. But that's beside the point. What I was really saying is there's this all-pervasive insecurity about being inadequate. And we project onto God this constant judgment that he is judging us and finding us inadequate. So an enormous part of the role of anyone who would help people spiritually is to be just unconditionally encouraging. No, it's fine. Whatever you're doing is fine. Don't worry about it. Whatever if that's all you can meditate, that's good enough. If you can't meditate, just come to Sangha. And if you can't come to the Sangha, well then just go on the internet. And if you can't go on the internet, just write Om on your pillow with your finger before you fall asleep at night. You know, just anything except falling into the morass of guilt and shame. Bad enough that we mess up. But then if we feel guilty about it, you've just added a whole nother layer of mess to that. So that's one side of it, where we just try to do our best to tell people, whatever you're doing, just call it spiritual, you know, just go for it. And on the other side, that's just completely untrue. Because to really come to true spiritual understanding is really quite different than ordinary life. It just isn't about having it all. It's about giving up everything. Now, the key to that is, that makes you happy, not miserable. The key to all of this is that, as Swamiji said, it's not like you're totally in delusion and then pop, you know, you're in bliss. It's every step you take on the spiritual path is more and more joyful. Not necessarily even because you're not suffering or that you're not being tested like Job. I mean, it can be terrible circumstances sometimes. Sometimes it isn't, but nobody at Ananda is going to promise you a free ride. You know, it's just not true. Because everything finite has to be let go of before we can merge with the infinite. And once we make that commitment on any level that infinity is what I really seek, Divine Mother takes you seriously. She begins to work with you. And she begins to try to help you, me, us, realize, what a fool was I to turn away. That's what Patrick sang in that beautiful song, Love is a Magician. You know, all the time you were there. I was seeking all these other things, and all the time you were there. What a fool was I to turn away. Out of the thought, the real thought, that I will have to let go of my comfortable reality. You know, here then is the fourth and last stage, which is there is no self anymore. But the great secret of that is what bliss. Then we begin to see, I don't know what I was starting to say was, this woman came to see Swamiji in India, and I recall she was a disciple of Master, but she'd never met him, Swami. And all she kept repeating was, I thought when I got on the spiritual path it would get easier, and it's just gotten more and more difficult. And then she would sort of go through this litany of things that were wrong, and Swamiji kept trying to interject, you know, something a little more uplifting, but she would just give him, just as soon as he would stop for breath, she would just start in again. I thought it would get easier, you know, now that I thought if I lived for God, and Swami would try to say things, and what he kept trying to say to her was, it's so much easier because you understand why. You know, it's not just a sort of endless round of pointless change. It's the real